And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Mark Tedeschi, AMKC, the author of Missing, Presumed Dead. Mark was the senior Crown Prosecutor for 20 years up to 2018. He has had many articles published on the law, history, genealogy and photography. Mark was on this program in 2018 when we spoke about his book Massacre at Mile Creek. Mark, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Bill.
So, Mark, since you were last on this program, you've gone from being the senior prosecutor working for the Crown to being on the other side of the bar table, working privately. You have also changed from being Queen's Counsel to King's Counsel. How have you found the change?
Oh, well, look, I decided after 35 years as a Crown Prosecutor that I needed a change, and I also thought it was about time to give the leadership of the Crown Prosecutors to someone else. And I must admit that being a private barrister means that my administrative load is much, much less than it was when I was the leader of the Crown Prosecutors. So, yeah, it's quite different. I'm doing mainly defence work, although still a little bit of prosecution work and work for the police, but it's mainly defence work. I'm still enjoying it. I still get a real challenge out of it, and I'll continue doing it for as long as I do continue to enjoy it.
So, Missing, Presumed Dead is very topical, the main protagonist in your book, Bruce Burrell, being convicted on circumstantial evidence for murder. And recently we've had Chris Dawson, who's been convicted for murder of his wife after 40 years when the body was never found. So, people are sometimes surprised, but there is no need to actually have a body for a murder case, is there?
Look, Bill, a lot of people who don't have much contact with the law make the mistake of thinking that a circumstantial case is necessarily weaker than a direct evidence case. And nothing could be further from the truth. In a murder trial, sure, the first thing that you have to prove is the death of the victim. If you have a body, it's obviously easy to prove death. But there are other ways of proving death, and the two women that my book is about, Kerry Whelan and Dorothy Davis, there were no bodies that were found to this day, but it was not difficult to prove death by other means. And when you have people like those two women who had very loving family lives, who were very active in the community, who had assets and contacts in every aspect of their lives and plans for the future in their diaries, and in relation to whom, from one day to the next, there was just complete and utter absence of anything and everything, it's not that difficult to prove death.
In the Burrell case, well, it was necessary to go to the coronial inquest, really, to get the case going, wasn't it? Because the first attempt, the case fell over.
Yes, it was. That was not because of any difficulty in proving death. That was for a variety of reasons. At that stage, at the initial stage, it was in the hands of another prosecutor who took the matter to a pre-trial hearing. The Supreme Court judge who heard the matter excluded some of the evidence, and the DPP then announced a decision that the Kerry Whelan murder matter would not go to trial. And it was at that stage that the officer in charge of the investigation, Chief Inspector Dennis Bray, made a decision to take both the Kerry Whelan murder and the Dorothy Davis murder to the coroner. And the coroner had a hearing in relation to both disappearances, at which Bruce Burrell was called to give evidence. And he exercised his right to silence and answered, I think it was something like 84 questions with the response, on legal advice, I decline to answer that question, or similar words. And those questions included questions like, were you responsible for the murder of Kerry Whelan? Were you responsible for the murder of Dorothy Davis? Are you a predator of wealthy women? Questions like that, that he declined to answer. There was a tiny bit more evidence that was unearthed in that coroner's hearing, and the coroner then wrote to the DPP, and that prompted the DPP to make a public announcement that not only would Burrell be prosecuted in relation to the Kerry Whelan murder, but also in relation to the Dorothy Davis murder.
And then you were brought in. You showed, I have to say, enormous patience, considering the number of times this case got started. And anyway, it eventually, I think, reached the right conclusion. But in the case of Bruce Burrell...
Well, one of my reasons for writing the book was to explain to ordinary people who don't have the opportunity of going to court why these cases take so long. As you say, Bill, it was a torturous process to get these matters to trial and then at trial. And a lot of people don't understand the difficulties of a police investigation and then the difficulties of bringing a matter to trial. So, as I said, one of the reasons why I wrote the book was to explain those things to the ordinary reader.
It seems that things have changed because you point out in your earlier book, Kidnapped, about the Graham Thorne case in 1960, that I think that trial was set down for 1 or 2 days?
That trial, if my memory serves me correctly, went for just over a week, which was a long trial at that time. But by the time we came to the trials of Bruce Burrell in the early 2000s, trials had expanded exponentially. And each of those trials took about 3 months. So one of the issues, of course, is are we doing justice any better than we did back in the 1960s when a long trial was a week? And, look, that's a debate that lawyers often have.
Without resolving it by the sound of it. But, Bruce Burrell and the subject of your book, Kidnapped, namely Stephen Bradley, and now Chris Dawson, as I mentioned, in none of these cases, even after the convictions, would the murderers tell where the bodies are. Why do you think this is so?
Look, I've had many experiences of people who have been convicted of very, very serious crimes, particularly murders, who have got very long sentences. And the experience is, not just in New South Wales, but throughout Australia, that people who have received those long sentences do not generally admit to their crimes, and there are a number of reasons for that. In the case of Bruce Burrell, I think that you have to understand that he was pretty much of a control freak, and this was the last area of his life, once he was in jail, that he had some control over. But I think there's a more significant reason that applies more generally to people, and that is if you've been convicted of a very serious crime and you're serving a very long sentence, there might be only two or three people who still support you on the outside. And those contacts with the outside world are terribly important. And maintaining credibility with those few people who still support you, I think, is very important to people in that situation. And I think that explains why people like Bruce Burrell continue to deny their responsibility for these terrible crimes, even until their deaths. Because that contact with the outside world, those few people who still visit them and speak to them, those contacts are terribly important.
There have been some recent law changes, I think, proposed in New South Wales, where they're saying that parole will be denied if the location of the body is not disclosed by the murderer, by the offender. Do you think that will have an effect?
Look, I think it's unlikely to have an effect. the experience in other states and territories where they've had that rule for some time, according to what I've read, is that there hasn't been a single body that's been located as a result of that legislation. And look, I think that it's an important part of the jail system for encouraging rehabilitation and also for encouraging good behaviour to have a system that includes parole. And if you deny people parole at a time when they're denying responsibility for their actions, I think it runs counter to other aims and objectives of our jail system. So I'm not in favour of it generally.
We might take a break at this point, and Mark, we always ask our guests if they'd like to pick a piece of music for our show. Have you got one you've selected for us?
Oh, gosh. Look, I particularly like the Elgar Cello Concerto, so one of them would be lovely.
Any in particular?
No, I don't mind. I'll leave it up to you.
Okay, take the risk. And that was the Elgar Cello Concerto in E minor, Opus 85, performed by Jacqueline Dupre. And we're speaking today with Mark Tedeschi. And we're talking about his book, Missing Presumed Dead, which is the story of the abduction and the disappearance of two women, Kerry Whelan and Dorothy Davis. And in fact, the story is bigger than that, but we'll get to that in a moment. So, Mark, in your books, you give a clear view into the minds of a killer. It was a near thing in the case of Bruce Burrell getting the conviction, but and what do you think he would have done next if that if it hadn't started with that coronial inquest and leading to a trial, or if the jury had not reached a decision, which they didn't on their first attempt?
Bruce Burrell's murder of Dorothy Davis occurred in 1995. There was a very cursory police investigation of that, and had he not abducted and murdered Kerry Whelan in 1997, I think that he would have got away with the Dorothy Davis murder. There's also a very strong suspicion that he was involved in an earlier murder of a man by the name of Charlie Spears, who lived near him in Lurline Bay. There was never enough evidence to charge him, but Charlie's disappearance bore some striking similarities to the disappearances of Dorothy Davis and Kerry Whelan. So were it not for the very intensive and dedicated police investigation after the disappearance and kidnapping of Kerry Whelan, he probably would have got away with the murders. Once he was identified as the prime suspect in the Kerry Whelan disappearance, and the police attention of a large investigative squad focused really almost entirely on him, I think that his days were numbered.
Murder is a sort of crime which I suspect you only do once. Now, in this case, and for that reason, that makes it a bit easier for the police because they're investigating murders all the time, whereas the murderer may only be in this situation once. But in this case, Bruce Burrell, we think, started with Charlie Spears and finished with Kerry Whelan, but he didn't get better at murdering. He actually got worse because he left more clues in the last one than in the first one.
Bruce Burrell left a whole lot of clues in relation to the disappearance of Kerry Whelan, and I think that the reasons why those clues were left has a lot to do with his narcissistic personality. And he was a severe case of that. And he had this belief that the universe owed him a living. He had this belief that he had superior ability to plan this kidnapping and murder and get away with it. And he was completely oblivious to the fact that he was leaving clues. And it's very similar in some ways to the disappearance and murder of the young boy in 1960, Graham Thorne. I think that with Bruce Burrell, he went and visited Kerry Whelan about 3 weeks before she disappeared. And he went and visited her in strange circumstances where there didn't seem to be much point to the visit. And then about a week or so, or even a few days prior to that visit, he had spoken on the phone to Kerry Whelan's husband, Bernie Whelan, and Bernie Whelan was mystified by the conversation because there seemed no point to it. But in the course of that conversation, Bernie had mentioned that every second Wednesday he would go to Adelaide, and of course it was the very next Wednesday that Burrell turns up at their home at Kurrajong. He left a trail. He also was a lazy kidnapper. He had prepared a ransom note, which he was obviously planning to leave at Kerry's house on the day that he went to her home and visited her, thinking that she'd be alone. And it turned out that she was not alone, so he had to change his plan. And the change of plan involved meeting her at Parramatta and convincing her to get into his car. But he was lazy in that he'd constructed this ransom note at some considerable effort because he had to ensure that there were no fingerprints on it, no DNA on it. He had to buy some parts for his electronic typewriter so that his typewriter couldn't be traced. And having done the first note for a scenario where he was going to leave the note at her home, where it would be found by the family before the police had been informed of her disappearance, he just decided to use the same note, which after meeting her and her getting into his car at Parramatta, he posted on the way down to his remote bush property at Bungonia. Now, that note, as it turned out, arrived the next day, but it could have arrived two or three days later. And, of course, it demanded that the police not be informed about her disappearance. And, of course, her family had already notified the police. So it was a completely mystifying demand that didn't make any sense. And what the police eventually concluded was that it was a demand that was formulated for a different scenario in which the family, that the family would not have notified the police before they received the ransom note. So that narrowed the circumstances in which a kidnapper could have access to Kerry Whelan. And I explain all this in the book in some detail. Mm. It's quite an intricate story. Mm. But those are some examples in which Bruce Burrell was very careless about this kidnapping.
I guess it's typical of psychopaths, but for all this that we talk about Bruce Burrell, he must have been very persuasive because he managed to get the code to get access to Kerry Whelan's property and come and meet with her, and he got that from the nanny on the property by persuading her to give him the code, and he also got a mate to lie about being at a office party at the time Dorothy Davis was being killed. Was he that sort of persuasive person? Did you
absolutely
find it?
Absolutely. Being a classic narcissist, he knew exactly how to get around people to do his bidding. He could be very engaging. He could be very charismatic. He could be very appealing. He could be very persuasive. He also knew how to be very threatening. And there were other women who had given him money, and when they came to demand it back, he could very easily convince them that it wasn't worth their while to do that. But Dorothy Davis was made of sterner stuff, and she made the demand for $100,000 that she'd lent him to be paid back. And he adopted his usual approach of being intimidating and threatening, using his big physical bulk, because he was quite a big man. But she told him that if he didn't pay it back, she would not only hand the matter over to her solicitor, but she would tell Bruce's wife, Dallas, who was a close friend of hers, about this loan of $100,000. Now, for a classic narcissist like Bruce Burrell, the threat of legal proceedings wouldn't have had much effect. But the shame associated with his wife finding out that he'd managed to convince this 74-year-old widow to lend him $100,000 on a pretext, and that he had no way of paying it back, that was completely unacceptable and insupportable. And for a classic narcissist like him, the threat of being shamed in front of your loved ones is a very potent force. And it was that prompted him to devise a way of murdering Dorothy Davis so that he didn't have to pay back that money because he'd spent it all. And he also avoided the risk of being shamed.
You'll find in this book that there is a lot of extraordinary detail on this extraordinary case, but there are still quite a few mysteries to get your thinking. I mean, one of them, I suppose, is why on earth did Kerry Whelan agree to meet secretly with Burrell in Parramatta, which was the last meeting she ever had? I mean, how did he convince her to do that and not tell anybody?
Look, at the end of the trial, there were still some enduring mysteries, Bill, and that was one of them. What was it that he said to her that convinced her to meet him some weeks later at Parramatta and get into his car? I've got my own theories, which I advance in the book. The police have a few theories of their own, and I've given quite a few talks at bookshops and libraries and community groups about this book, and some of my readers have some interesting hypotheses about how he convinced her to meet him like that. But look, ultimately, it's just hypotheses. We don't actually have any evidence of exactly what he said to her. All that we know is that he convinced her to meet him. He convinced her to voluntarily get into his car, and he convinced her to keep it a secret. But in the book, I go through some of the evidence that was excluded from the trial, including the route that he was planning to take from where he picked her up in Parramatta. And it's based upon that route that I think that I have a pretty good idea of where she thought they were going.
Well, one of the other surprises in this book is that, as covered in your previous book, Kidnapped, that the kidnapping of Graham Thorne was the first, I think, in New South Wales, and now the second is this very case, 37 years later, where Kerry Whelan was kidnapped. Because I'm sure people think there are more than that.
Look, what we're talking about is kidnapping for ransom, which is very rare in Australia, thankfully, because in some other countries it's much more common. We're just very fortunate here in Australia that it's not a common crime. Today, we've got what I call the CSI effect, where if you're doing a trial and you don't have some DNA evidence, the jury wonder, well, why not? Because watching CSI, it seems so simple to get traces of DNA. The reality is that it's not nearly as simple as it appears on television to get DNA from a perpetrator. And when I was prosecuting, I would sometimes have to call evidence from a scientific expert to explain to jurors why there were no fingerprints or why there was no DNA evidence, because both can be very hard to get and both can deteriorate very quickly, particularly in the open air outside.
Look, there are so many avenues to explore in this new book by our special guest Mark Tedeschi. The book is called Missing Presumed Dead. And I should mention that the proceeds from the sale of this book are going to Australian charities that assist and support victims of crime, families of deceased victims, and relatives of those who have gone missing. So it just remains for me now to give a very special thank you to our guest, Mark Tedeschi. Mark, thank you very much for being a guest on Dad's on the Air.
Thank you, Bill. My pleasure.
And we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.